Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, and each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now here's today's podcast.
Provision is a new app made by Christians for Christians. It's designed to help you spend, save and give with greater purpose. You can link as many available UK bank accounts as you like and keep track of everything, simply in one place. Set reminders to pray when your regular giving goes out, or to give thanks when God provides. It's not about control. It's about making informed choices rooted in faith. Steward your money wisely with the new Provision app. Download now at provision.money and use code PREMIER to get your first month free. That's code PREMIER at provision.money.
Good afternoon and welcome along to the programme. This is Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half here on Unbelievable. It's the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together every week for dialogue and debate, and hopefully helps you, wherever you sit on the faith spectrum, to think through the big issues. If you want to listen back to past programmes and get your hands on plenty of past resources too, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable is the webpage. You can find the podcast links there. You can find videos, articles and lots of other stuff. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. And the show, of course, is part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio every Saturday afternoon. And completing the round of shows after Unbelievable between 4 and 5, you can hear The Profile. And one of the guests on that is Rico Tice, who's evangelist at All Souls Church Langham Place, talking about his new book on evangelism to Sam Hale. So listen out for that. We've got some of your feedback towards the end of today's programme, and I'll be giving you the ways to get in touch, both by email and online. But right now, let's get into today's discussion.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the show we're asking, does prayer make sense? And to help us think through that, David Wilkinson and Ed Atkinson join me. David is principal of St John's College in Durham, with a background as a physicist himself. And in his new book, When I Pray, What Does God Do?, he unpacks the issues of why many prayers are apparently unanswered and how science, scripture and theology interact with the subject of prayer. We're going to be finding out about it and about how he approaches prayer himself. Ed Atkinson is a former Christian. He's been on the show before too. He now helps to run a discussion group of believers and non-believers. He lost his faith partly as a result of feeling that his prayers for God to make his existence apparent to him went unanswered, as well as other reasons, of course. But we'll come to all that in the course of today's programme. Hope you enjoy listening. Great to have you both on the programme, gentlemen. It's always fun to have two guests in the studio for a face-to-face interaction.
Thank you.
It's good to have you back as well, David. A couple of years ago, since I think you came on to talk about extraterrestrial life.
Yes, indeed.
So you turn your hand in many interesting directions, always to some extent drawing on your scientific yes. background, of course. Just very briefly, for those who aren't familiar with who you are, you became a Christian shortly after, I think, starting your scientific education.
The two went along together, really. I became a Christian at the age of 17, just as I started a physics degree at university, just about the same time. And so for me, science and faith have always grown up together, posing often difficult questions to each other, but ultimately questions that in the search I've found fruitful, both to my excitement with science and my excitement with faith.
You've been a preacher for quite a long time, I think, in the Methodist Church.
Yes.
You've been an active Christian in that sense. And prayer, presumably, has been part of your life from when you first came to faith.
Yes, it has been, although I've struggled with prayer. And I want to be really honest about this. I mean, I have. You get often bogged down with different forms of prayer. What's the best form of prayer? Do you pray in the morning? Do you pray in the evening? Pray with your hands aloft, hands clasped in a nonconformist crouch, all the rest of it. And I think one of the things that that I've learnt over the years is it's easy to get wrapped up with the techniques of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, at the heart, understanding what's going on in prayer is much more interesting, much more important. The kind of God that I'm praying to, or the kind of God that I'm imagining, or what I'm actually asking for or not asking for is really important. And Martin Lloyd-Jones, a great Reformed preacher, once said that the most difficult thing in the Christian life is prayer.
Mm.
And I thought to myself, that's a bit odd. I mean, there's lots of more difficult things.
Yes.
But actually, I think he was right, that because of the questions that prayer poses and the reality of life, the reality of suffering, the reality of the hope that prayer offers, how you think through all of those.
Mm.
So although I've prayed and I'm still an active prayer, that doesn't underestimate some of the difficulties that there are with prayer.
Yeah. And there, you cover a wide range of stuff in the book. I'm so impressed. It's very accessible as well, the number of different things you ask and draw out about prayer. One of the interesting things, though, is on a personal level, you talk about the fact that one of the struggles and questions that have been brought up with prayer is the fact that your wife has suffered from a debilitating illness. Do you want to just...
Yes, Alison, my wife, is a Methodist pastor. She was leading a growing church in Durham, and very much a person of energy and preaching and teaching. And then in her early 40s, after a series of minor illnesses, which we look back on, these were the start of it, was deeply affected by rheumatoid arthritis, which, of course, is a disease where the immune system attacks the body. And that's very difficult to deal with. You can't cure it. You can only limit it. And it hit her very strongly while she was minister of this growing church. She lost a great deal of ability to move and walk, with pain and particularly tiredness, which is part of the disease. And so from a point of view where lots of people were praying for her, our family, our friends, Christians in the church, for a year and a half she couldn't work at all until the drugs were beginning to be sorted. She found some kind of stability, but even now she's only able to work part-time.
Right.
She isn't able to do the role that she feels God called her originally to do. And, of course, we've all experienced something like that, those of us who've prayed, of unanswered prayer, of the sense of, well, Lord, obviously, here's someone who's making a difference for you. Why?
Yeah. It seems the perfect opportunity for you to display your power and be a witness.
Absolutely. And lots of people are praying,
Of
people are praying with faith.
Yeah.
So why does this illness go on? Mm. Why isn't there a miraculous cure? And by the way, I see a miraculous cure over here, so why not here?
Yeah.
And I think it's when it becomes personal that it's actually really difficult. You can talk about it in an intellectual sense, but the experience of unanswered prayer, when it affects someone you love, is really quite profound and not to be underestimated in its complexity or its difficulty.
I totally concur with that, having seen friends close to me who have gone through exactly the same sort of crisis brought on by unanswered prayer, who might have seen themselves as very big believers in prayer previously. So we're going to talk about the book today, and we'll talk about both maybe scientific aspects of the question of prayer and how that works, if we believe in an ordered universe and so on. But certainly this question of are there any reasons why God may not answer prayer, or is it all just in our heads, our imagination? And Ed Atkinson is here and is going to talk to us about his experience on this front. As an atheist now, was a Christian at one time. So in a sense, you used to do a lot of praying, is my guess.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Yeah. I mean, just walk us quickly through what happened to you again, because in a sense, when you started to doubt your faith, you did a lot of praying, asking God to reveal himself to you.
Yes, that's right. So when I became a Christian as a teenager from an atheist childhood background, there were two big things that were the motivation. One was that I should know God. This, you know, the creator of the universe, who has a caring, loving relationship with us as individuals, just amazing. And that I was sort of part of the force for good in the world, to see the healing coming to the world. And as the years went on, I was in church for about sort of 20 years nearly, and just pitched in with everything, led the youth work, all that sort of thing, even became an elder briefly. I was always praying that I would know God, and I never felt I got through. It was always this experience of praying to the ceiling and just silence coming back. And this was a charismatic church, so we were doing everything going with deliverance and inner healing and Toronto blessings, just the whole works. But nothing seemed to sort of break me open. And then in parallel with that, which is probably more relevant to today, I was beginning to notice that there was no correlation between what we prayed for and what happened. So good things happened. Maybe we'd prayed, maybe we hadn't. Bad things happened. Maybe, we hadn't bothered to pray, but maybe we were praying and nothing, you know, it didn't pitch up. There was nothing equivalent to your story with a deep heartache that kind of nagged away, except perhaps I was praying for my dad for all that time, and maybe the sort of straw that broke the camel's back was when he died, clearly not as a believer.
So you were praying for him to become a believer?
That's right.
That, not for his healing in that sense, but for salvation?
Yes, that's right.
But he didn't. I mean, that's really kind of interesting and honest story, Ed. And in a way, I'm sure you're not the only person who's experienced that. They may not have, as it were, finally decided, I'm going to become an atheist. But there may be people who sort of have
yes.
always had that sort of sense of, I just don't connect. I don't feel like my prayers go anywhere. And that
yes.
kind of thing.
I became not an atheist, but I stepped outside the faith consciously to say, okay, I want this to be true, but it needs to be true because it's true, not because of my experiences backing it up, because it isn't. So then I went to the local library and then a theological college library in Oxford, and I spent several years reading up and searching it, and eventually ended up as an agnostic, thinking, oh, there might be something in it, but there just isn't enough to live off. And then more recently I've come back to it, and I'm still an agnostic, but I'm...
You've re-engaged in the debates, certainly,
since
discovering this show, obviously,
and that's
been great. I mean, you now, as I say, run a believer, non-believer discussion group, hoping to get one set up in London as well.
I would love that.
Yeah. So you still see that there's obviously a lot of good comes out of having the discussions.
Yes.
And something that you're obviously still interested in.
Yes.
But we're going to talk about prayer today. Just be interested to know, do you ever catch yourself, Ed, even as an atheist, occasionally praying without kind of realising it? I don't know, how ingrained is it, I guess I wonder.
No, it's not ingrained at all, but I love praying. Is this relevant to sort of, it's a bit of a tangent, but I do like talking about this.
Tangents are fine.
It's really related to your shows a couple of years ago with the Atheist Prayer Experiment.
Oh, yes.
Doing it as an individual, I'm a massive advocate of. It's like if you have a friendly kind of uncle or something, and he's blind, and you visit his house, and it's a dark night, and you don't know if he's in or not. Do you look for evidence? Do you smell if there's cooking in the kitchen, or do you grope around the dark, feeling all the seats, or do you ask him, "Are you there?" So, if I'm a person who really wants to know the truth and follow it, the best resource I've got is God. So I ask him to reveal himself to me. And also it's a fantastic kind of self-check.
Yeah.
I humble myself before God and ask him. I'm not playing silly games. Well, maybe because I've been a Christian, I know I'm not saying, maybe for someone who's never been a Christian it's different. But, you know, I know doing that, if I'm pretending or not,
yes.
exposing myself to the in my
and there's a certain honesty in doing that,
yes,
I think. Maybe we'll talk about that in a moment's time. Might be a good place to start today. But just before we get into talking about prayer, if you'd like to send your thoughts in about today's show, you can always email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We'll hear some of your feedback towards the end of today's show on recent programmes as well. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter account, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow the show on Facebook and get regular updates about what's coming up. and so on. Don't forget all of those links and past shows, more resources, and all the extra goodies available at the show webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. This is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and discussion. We're talking about prayer today.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
We're asking, does prayer make sense? David Wilkinson, a principal of St John's College Durham, has written a book, When I Pray, What Does God Do? It's published by Monarch. And I'd really recommend it, actually. Really easy to read, but covers a lot of ground. And we'll just be trying to cover just a bit of that ground today as he dialogues with Ed Atkinson, our former Christian, who is going to be asking some of the tough questions about prayer. Just sticking with that thing about, you mentioned about, we ran this thing, David, a few years ago now on the show. We call it the Atheist Prayer Experiment. I invited atheists who listened to the programme to try to pray for 40 days, maybe once a day, for God to reveal himself to them. Got quite a lot of people who signed up to it. Now, some people dropped out at some point in the process. One or two people, but in a slightly sort of interesting way, not quite within the remits of the experiment, said that they had an experience which they put down to God. Others had interesting experiences, but they weren't prepared to assign them to God. Some said, I felt nothing at all. Nothing at all happened to me. And it was a really interesting thing. Some Christians weren't convinced it was a good idea in the first place. They said, sounds a bit like putting God to the test. I mean, do we really, you know, and there might be a case for doing this in a personal, private way, but doing it sort of for a sort of a media experiment might not be the best way to expect God to answer. Anyway, we went ahead and did it, and it was very interesting. What do you make of that sort of an approach and sort of atheists just sort of putting it out there and saying, God, if you're there, tell me?
My background as a scientist means that I'm really open to experimenting with the world and indeed experimenting with our experience of God. I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong on that. And I think that's different to putting God to the test. Mm-hmm. The use of science in prayer or trying to analyze the results of prayer goes back a long way. Galton looked at what he called the prayer experiment over 100 years ago, and he looked at whether the life span of kings, missionaries, or priests was longer than normal people because he felt that they were being prayed for each week and therefore they should live longer. Yeah. The trouble is, of course, for missionaries going to different parts of the world and all the diseases that were there, and then the genetic constitution perhaps of royalty and the type of people who put themselves forward for ministry in those days, there are so many variables. This is the thing, as a mere physicist, I can reduce the variables and do a physics experiment quite easily. With prayer, there are so many different variables here that you've got to be very subtle in the way that you judge answers to prayer or these kind of experiments. But I don't want to simply say we shouldn't do this sort of thing. I think Ed's honesty and particularly a sense of humility as we come to it, so that we don't just do it as an experiment where we hope to triumph. But actually, there's an honest search. I think at the heart of prayer, biblically, is this sense that there is an honest search for God. And I can't read the Psalms, for example, without knowing that there are some very honest questions being asked in the Psalms about times when God doesn't seem to be there, when God doesn't answer prayer. And there's an honesty to that. And I think the more honesty that we have as we talk about prayer, the better, and to avoid the simplistic answers.
And in a sense, you know, we're unable to judge from our perspective the heart of anybody making a sincere prayer.
Absolutely.
Obviously, only God's the kind of being able That's to right. do that. But what about other sort of types of experiments? So we had, again, a few years ago before he passed away, Victor Stenger, atheist physicist, on, and he was very adamant that the results that had been done of empirical testing, you know, where they one group had been prayed for and another not prayed for in a hospital,
yes,
recovery
right.
rates and so on, showed that there was nothing to it, and that, and he believed that gave empirical evidence against the existence of God, for instance.
I don't think it gives empirical evidence against the existence of God, and I don't think it would have given us empirical evidence for the existence of God. The so-called step experiment and others, which had two groups of heart patients and one group prayed for and the other not. Just, again, I mean, my toes curl at that as a scientist, because there are too many variables. You don't know whether family or friends, for example, are praying for one group rather than just the group of Christians who are going on. And a number of us really felt that that was an experiment which really went too far, that you couldn't gain any significant output out of it because of its it was too difficult to interpret.
And as many people made the point after we recorded that show debating that, the ultimate variable in the sense that you can't control for is God. God is under no obligation to take part in your experiment.
That's absolutely right. And that may seem a simple point to make, but it's a very profound point to make. A lot of us, particularly within the Christian church, have a very mechanistic view of God. He is the divine slot machine. You put enough prayer or enough faith in at the top, you pull the handle, and if you're lucky, you'll get an answer out of the end. Now, God, within the Christian tradition, is not that mechanistic responder to prayer. There is, at the heart of God, within the Christian tradition, God as personal, God in relationship, God in love, and we all know that in personal relationships, predictability is not the easiest of things. I've been married for a number of years now, and I know that very well. That actually, but that's part of the relationship of love, the depth of love. Now, again, that's not a simplistic way to excuse some of the big unanswered questions. But I think it is a reminder that the kind of God that we pray to, or how we vision God, image God, is really important in all of this.
Well, maybe we'll return to some of the scientific issues later as well. Talk about miracles and the physics and so on, and whether, you know, how that all works when it comes to prayer. But Ed, I wanted to make sure you're able to ask some of the questions you want to ask. So where do you want to start with this whole topic? What would it be, the fact of unanswered prayer? Is that one of the big issues for you that put a barrier on you being able to see that there is any sense in prayer?
Well, if I would go back to where I started, I'd sort of put a little challenge out and then see whether it goes. And then I've got more questions rather than challenges later on. We, as human beings, we just make up meanings all the time. So the traditional thing is the twig in the forest. It probably means something, but we make it mean something instantly because it could be of our survival benefits.
We kind of assume that there's some kind of agency going on, even.
Yes, we detect agency all the time.
It's helpful for us to assume that, even if it's not necessarily true.
So if I say the train was late, and then I got caught in the shower coming in, and then I found that Justin had cancelled the recording, those three things, I would have made them mean something, and I would have to have actively switched off that process in my brain to say, well, those were just three uncoordinated events. So that's the power of meaning that we have, of making it up. Then when it comes to our lives as Christians, we are making everything mean something. So if it goes well, God's blessing me. If it goes badly, I'm being tested, or Satan's trying to upset the apple cart, or whatever. So it's like we have God glasses on. And
we kind of apply a retrospective filter to everything that happens to us to sort of make it have a meaning in that sense.
So I suppose that what I'm sort of coming to is that with all this confirmation bias going on, that there really is nothing to it. That obviously that's the atheist viewpoint that I want to sort of get tested out. So that in your life you say you have seen some positive results to prayer, but how do you know that that isn't just your confirmation bias?
Are you just ticking the answers and discounting all the notes?
Selectivity of evidence as well. So not just how we interpret the evidence, but what evidence we select. So I go and listen to a preacher who tells me all about the answers to prayer, doesn't tell me anything about the lack of answers to prayer. And how we use an interpretive framework on the world, I think, is a really important challenge. I don't have an easy answer to that. I think we're back to honesty as very important, and unanswered prayer to challenge that. So if I'm talking myself or listening to someone where there is no mystery to the practice of prayer or the reality of unanswered prayer, I'm going to be skeptical whether they're simply interpreting the world through these, I wouldn't say God glasses, but the kind of positive, I believe that God answers every prayer that I say in one way or another. So honesty in answered prayer is really important. I think, however, we all interpret the world from our own worldview perspective. It's really difficult to separate ourselves from basic assumptions about the world. We do that even as scientists. I have a number of assumptions as a physicist about the universality of the laws of physics, and therefore, when I look out into the universe, I believe that the law of gravity around a black hole is the same law of gravity that controls the flight of my golf ball. Not very far, but nevertheless, it does. I make that assumption, and then I look at the world to see whether that assumption is verified or whether there's something much deeper that breaks that assumption. And that's why I think these kind of discussions, and particularly discussions about unanswered prayer, become extremely important. Because I think there is a problem with much Christian dialogue in interpreting everything in a way that actually shouldn't be interpreted in that way.
Yeah.
But is it your contention, though, that if you took a sort of dispassionate, objective view of what, when, you know, if you had a sort of scientist come along and look at what's happening in a Christian's life, they'd get a different outcome, if you like, for the actually whether God seems to be acting and moving in their life than the Christian would, because they're sort of in that world and they've got this confirmation bias and so on.
Yes, I'd say two things on that. One is that I have seen it from both sides and come to the same conclusion from both sides. So I'm as close to passionate as you can get in this sort of messy situation. And the other thing is, if there is an effect, it wouldn't be maybe measurable under clear scientific conditions, but you would expect, say, Christian families to be better off because of all the little answers to prayer going on than non-Christian families.
Better off?
Well, it's difficult to say because, I mean, you know, they're probably not smoking and wasting money on that. They, you know, there are lots of lifestyle issues that will make them better off anyway, and then being in community and churches is known to be a very healthy way of living. So there's lots of reasons why Christians could be better off. But if there's the whole prayer thing going on as well, you'd expect something more arresting than that.
Right. You'd expect their lives to look significantly different from their non-Christian counterparts.
Yes, if there is something in answer to prayer regularly happening.
Now, I think I think I'd want to be quite strong at an anecdotal level of experiences where I've observed that. The difficulty with large-scale effects and trials is, again, this problem of a number of different variables. So I think I would want to be quite clear that when I meet people who are people of prayer, there is something about their lives which marks them out. The difficulty is then having a large trial field where you don't quite know what's going on in the background. So what's going on behind the mask? Lots of Christians will say, oh yes, we pray hours or whatever, because they're embarrassed to say that actually, you know, on average, most Christians pray for about 30 seconds a day or 2 minutes a day. Mm. Other dynamics are coming in family life and all the rest of it. So I think it's difficult to go beyond the personal instance or experience, but certainly at an anecdotal level, and I don't want to totally discount that, although I'm aware of its limitations, there is something about people of prayer which there's a different texture to their lives, which I've noticed, experienced.
And when you say people of prayer, people who, as far as you can tell, really do spend a significant amount of time.
Yes,
in
I mean,
prayer.
They won't shout from the rooftops that that's what they do often. But one gets to know, I mean, when I was a pastor in Liverpool for 10 years, One or two of the folk who were housebound, and eventually they'd tell me their story, and they'd find that they spent a lot of time in prayer. They weren't great evangelists or great writers or speakers or anything of that sort. But they had a quality of joy, a quality of peace about them,
right,
which impressed me greatly.
Yeah.
And I have to report that, and I've seen it and experienced it.
We're going to take a quick break and come back to you, Ed, as we continue this discussion on Does Prayer Make Sense? David Wilkinson joins me, author of When I Pray, What Does God Do? And Ed Atkinson, former Christian, as we discuss. We're going to talk about the physics of prayer as well. And, of course, this fundamental question, which we still haven't really got to grips with yet. Why doesn't God answer prayer more? So join us again in just a moment's time here on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In the latest edition, we find out why Christianity is under attack where the church is growing fastest, in Africa. We speak to pro wrestling star Shawn Michaels on his conversion to Christ. R.T. Kendall shares an open letter to the UK church. And we ask whether Christians should watch horror movies, as Jonty Langley makes the case for scary films. Get your free copy today and check out the news, reviews and brilliant columnists too.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme. Talking about prayer today on the show, my guests are David Wilkinson and Ed Atkinson. Don't forget that you can email in and give your thoughts on prayer. Perhaps you've got, you know, what you think is an absolutely copper-bottom, iron-cast proof of an answered prayer that you'd like to share with us. Perhaps you're someone who's in Ed's situation who says, I tried, it just didn't seem to happen for me. Be interested to hear from you either way. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We'll read out some of your responses to previous shows as well towards the end of today's programme. And so as we talk about prayer, you might want to get hold of a copy of David Wilkinson's book, When I Pray, What Does God Do? He's principal of St John's College, Durham. He's got a background as a physicist. He writes all kinds of interesting books. But this one on prayer has sparked a lot of interest in our discussion today with Ed Atkinson, former Christian, who, in his personal experience, didn't find that prayers got answered. He just saw it in the end as sort of really what happens in life. Some things go well, some things go badly. Prayer doesn't seem to impact it in either direction. So we're going to talk about that, unanswered prayer, as we get into this second part of the programme now, Ed. Because, you know, whether you're an atheist or a Christian, the issue of unanswered prayer is a pretty significant one, as we've already heard. You want to pick it up from the point of view of the Bible, though.
Yes, that's right, because this is another big area of confusion. There's obviously the area of guilt and everything around the issue of faith. But I want to read out some verses that don't mention faith. So from John's Gospel, chapter 14, Jesus saying, "And I will do whatever you ask in my name, so that the Son may bring glory to the Father. You may ask me for anything in my name, and I will do it." Chapter 15, "If you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be given for you." Given to you. And then the famous Ask, Seek, Knock from the Synoptics. This is Luke's version of it. "So I say to you, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. He who seeks finds. To him who knocks, the door will be opened."
Yeah, it seems almost unequivocal, really. The Jesus' teaching on prayer is, if you ask, you will receive.
Yes, but, as you'd expect me to say. I think there's a good Christian tradition of interpreting those verses by highlighting what it means to be in my name and the context of bringing glory to the Father. So the two verses from John 14 and John 15 are part of the farewell discourse in John's Gospel. They're part of this sense of the ongoing work that the disciples would be called to post the death and resurrection of Jesus. And I think context does matter here. And the context allows us to say, yes, but. I think there's something about an honesty of asking, just as I loved it when my daughter at the age of 3 asked me for a pony.
You naturally obliged, I assume.
Even though there was no garden, no place to put it in inner city Liverpool, I'd much rather than she asked, even if the answer was no,
right.
Or not yet, or never, or whatever. There's something about relationship which is about the asking. But within those verses, I think the context does matter, and it is about asking in my name for the glory of the Father. There's something about, is this prayer within the context of the kingdom that Jesus is bringing? Is this about a bigger concern than just my material wealth, my material good? The synoptic verse is a more interesting one, I think, in the sense of it's very unequivocal. Ask, and yet there's also the seek and you will find. There is a searching going on as well as an asking here. And again, I think that reminds us that this is not something that can be divorced from the searching, the seeking, the experiencing of relationship at the heart, which is about love, a God who loves all, not just me. The trouble in Western societies is that we've individualized this view of prayer into I ask for me.
Right.
Well, some of the most profound experiences of prayer that I've had have been in community, where one prays for the other, one prays for that which is beyond oneself. And the Hebrew Judeo-Christian tradition doesn't individualize prayer in the way that Western culture does. So I think there is an encouragement to pray. I think there's something about seeing it within the context of the glory of the Father. I think there's something about seeing it in the context of a relationship. And I think there's something about which is beyond individualism.
Does any of that help, Ed, or for you?
It sounds like a politician saying something.
The press
jumping on them,
apologising for the manifesto promises they never.
Yeah, they say something, put their foot in it, then the press jump on them and they say, "Oh, my words were misinterpreted. I didn't really say that." And it sounds like you're doing that to Jesus. It's completely clear. So why did God make the mistake of making something that could be interpreted so clearly as ask and you'll receive?
Oh, I don't think it can be very easily misinterpreted. I think one could argue that for the whole of the Bible, actually, that there are lots of verses which, taken out of context or taken without the background in which they happen to find themselves, can be easily misinterpreted. I mean, that is a risk in terms of the Christian understanding that God has embodied his revelation within mere words in a particular time, in a particular culture, in a particular place. So there is a risk to it that the words of Scripture can be misinterpreted. And gosh, we've seen that in lots of different ways, not just prayer, over many centuries. So, I think it's fair enough. One can say that does sound as if I'm qualifying the words of the Bible. But one of the things that I try and argue in the book, and I'd want to argue this very strongly, is that the biblical witness is taken as a whole quite complex when it talks about prayer. It's not simply a book of instructions on prayer. Many of the stories of prayer are stories. They're parables, they're instances, there's teaching alongside that. And there is not a simplistic view of prayer within the Bible. It's something, actually, that you have to struggle with, experience, enjoy, and yet at the same time be careful of.
Do you want to come back on any of that, Ed?
Well, I'm agreeing, but I'd agree by saying that, you know, the Bible was written by lots of different people at different times, and it has a mixed message on this issue because of the people didn't sort of compare notes that much. It's all come up in different ways. So, I mean, clearly there's examples of unanswered prayer in the Bible, which are, as you say, very honest and real.
I suppose what's interesting is even within, say, you know, a synoptic, though, you know, we could say has one author, one voice.
Yeah.
You have a verse like that. ask and you will receive. But you also get the story of Jesus not having his prayer answered in the way he wanted to when he's in the Garden of Gethsemane.
But that's clear, if it be your will.
So you think that's, in a sense, Jesus, that sort of made a difference to the nature of the prayer in that sense? If it be your will, take this cup away from me.
Yes, that's right. So it all makes sense what you're saying, that there's a God and he's a person and we shouldn't expect any predictability. It's a relationship, and that is to be celebrated, and it would be odd if every prayer you asked was answered. But then why is that expectation ranked up in these verses in the Gospels? It could have been so easy to sort of slip in, you know, if it's according to God's will or that sort of thing, instead of in this sort of code in my name, which sounds like it doesn't sound like it's a saying in my name, makes sort of undermines the whole message of the rest of the sentence.
I mean, I think it's a fair point. And there is a cultural embeddedness to the words of the Gospels. And they have to use the language of the time and the images of the time. And we then reinterpret those, and sometimes we reinterpret them in odd ways. I think that's just the fact that the Gospels are written at a particular time, at a particular place. And my contention, along with a number of scholars on John's Gospel, would be that would be understandable to the disciples and to the first Christians in terms of according to your will. It's our inability to fully understand that. And part of that is the way that we have taken the biblical witness and overlaid it with our own influences of Greek culture, individualism, the separation of spirit and body, a whole number of other things that have come in, which means that there is a task of reinterpreting this. And also the kind of urban myths of prayer that we live with, the kind of things that have been passed on by well-meaning Christians and well-meaning folk to say, well, this worked for me, so do it like this. So every time you say a prayer, say, in your name, Lord. And that will be an obvious way to make it work.
Again, that's the sort of the slot machine mentality. You put the right things in.
Yeah. It is. It, you know, it's the fact
that... I mean, what do you say, though, to the person who has gone through that awful situation of having a loved one suffering?
Yes.
And they've prayed as hard as they can. They've done everything they can, in a sense. They've heard, you know, you've got to repent of every unthought sin that you ever thought you needed to repent of, or whatever it might be. And they've tried desperately hard, and yet still that person dies, passes away, and so on. And they just don't understand that. What can you say to that person about prayer that is helpful at that point? Because for them it feels like, I did everything I possibly could, and it still didn't work.
The thing that I don't want to give is some kind of simple answer or rationalization for what's going on when actually there isn't anything to say. In the fullness of time, what I'd want to do is what's been important in my own experience, which is to point back to Jesus. Mm-hmm. So how do I cope with uncertainty and unpredictability and mystery and unanswered prayer? I've got to have some kind of evidence which holds me in that uncertainty and unpredictability. And for me, it comes back time and time again to the life, death and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, which shows me one or two things. First of all, the nature of God as love. Secondly, that God is free to work in the world in unusual ways. And thirdly, that evil will not triumph ultimately, that there is hope. Mm. Now, that's not the kind of set... simple answer to why my wife is suffering or why I've lost a loved one who's died. It's a much fuller context, but that's what holds me. Theology for me, and I'm these days I'm a professional theologian, often guards you from saying certain things. Its role is to tell you not what not to say rather than what to say at times. And sometimes I think the best answer is, I don't know.
Yeah.
I actually don't know. And the trouble is that filling the void too quickly gives a distorted view of who God is.
You're shaking your head, though, Ed.
Yeah, yeah.
Go on.
Well, can't you open yourself up to say, I'm going to step out of, in all your ways, acknowledge him and lean God and don't rely on your own understanding. Step away from that and think, hang on a minute. If you don't know, that could be because this whole thing is a big mistake. It's just a historical accident that Christianity took off.
Oh, you could. And that then leads us to, then our conversation is around the life, death and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. And we're into another conversation.
Another show. Another show.
That's right. I still loved it. We had a discussion group on that just last month, but just on the resurrection.
It is so important.
Yeah.
And it's so important for me personally that actually that holds me from just stepping out of it and saying, well, actually, this is a mistake.
Yeah.
That's the thing that holds me time after time after time.
Yeah.
Mm. Yes, because I mean, your faith then in that sense, David, is not based just on I can count this many times when God's answered prayer. It's also about a historical reality, as far as you're concerned.
Yes, it is. For me, faith is both about experience and evidence. Mm. Mm. The two have to be held together. Actually, an old preacher called Leslie Weatherhead used to use a silly illustration of a pair of scissors, that actually it's only when experience and evidence come together that faith has its cutting edge. And there are times in my life where the experience is very ambiguous. There are times in my life where, when I see answers to prayer, I have to be careful not to get carried away by that. And there are times when I don't see answers of prayer.
Because I get the feeling in your life, Ed, you might be sitting here still as a Christian today if you'd had the experience that you say you never seem to quite be able to have of God being real.
I guess I can't tell, but
it might have been enough to say, even if you did then go and investigate the evidence, actually I'm prepared on balance to treat these accounts as historically reliable and all the rest of it.
Right. I think if I hadn't looked at the evidence in 20 years, it didn't matter to me because I knew, well, I'd sort of pitched in with Christianity and that made sure that I was staying in it because of the, you know, it's bad faith to start thinking about evidence and look instead of dealing with your doubts in the spiritual way, you're dealing with your doubts by getting the books out and testing it. That wasn't, certainly in my culture of Christianity, that was not what you did.
Yeah. I mean, let me just toss in another thing. I think you deal with this at some point in the book, but some people find this a helpful maxim. Prayer doesn't change God, it changes me. I think C.S. Lewis actually at one point coined that.
Yes.
Is that a helpful maxim? I don't know. Sometimes it feels like there's something in there.
It's helpful as long as we don't limit God just to that.
Right.
So there are certainly times within the Bible where the answer to prayer is by people becoming the answer to prayer. In Matthew 9, when Jesus says to the disciples, pray that the Lord will send out workers into his harvest field. Only a few verses later in chapter 10, it's the disciples who are sent out. The ones who pray become the answer to their own prayer. And there's certainly the experience that God works in answer to prayer by changing us. What I don't want to do, however, is to simply say that's all God can do. Because I don't think that's true to the scriptural witness. I don't think that's true to my experience of how God works. And often that view has been taken because of the scientific paradigm of the Newtonian universe, which has said, from the time of Isaac Newton, the world is understandable and it's predictable. It's a bit like a clock. God created it perfect. Therefore, God can't poke his finger into the mechanism of the clock. But people say, oh, well, of course, he can poke his finger into the mind or the soul, and
because that's a sort of a separate entity.
Because that's a sort of separate entity, if people believe that.
Right.
And I don't think that's right.
Okay.
I think God can work in the mind in a way that affects the brain and affects action, but I don't want to limit God just to that. And part of the reason for that is, as a physicist of the 20th century and the 21st century, I have to say I don't believe in that Newtonian paradigm. It's very limited in the way that it explains the world. Chaos theory and quantum theory have shown us that Newton is very, very limited. In fact, the world is far more subtle, far more intriguing, far more open than we ever imagined it to be. And so I want to try and say, if God is the free creator of the universe, the one who upholds the physical laws of the universe, he has freedom to act within the universe as well as to uphold the laws.
Do you think, from your perspective, Ed, that there is any scientific objection to prayer in the sense of, or indeed a sort of conceptual idea that God could act in ways that essentially go against the, you know, what we see as the natural laws?
I read those chapters in the book, and he convinced me. You convinced me, David.
But convinced you of what? Convinced you that?
Well, that there's nothing logically incoherent about the idea of God making the laws and then choosing to override them as he best pleased in relationship with humans. No problem at all.
Well, that's interesting.
So, I do have questions.
I mean, was Hume one of the people who felt that there was a kind of a problem here with God sort of?
Yeah, Hume is one of the thinkers who built upon Newton, and so there was the sense of the predictability of the physical laws, and that was from Newton through Leibniz into Hume. Hume then put it together with a whole series of other objections, which is really what we've been talking about, and that is, how do you interpret the evidence? Mm-hmm. So Hume's point was that the evidence, particularly for miracles, was going to be often provided by people without an intellectual or philosophical background, that actually, how do you relate something that predictably happens time after time after time with the unusual?
Yes.
And also, Ed's point, which is well made, the difficulty of interpreting evidence. Mm-hmm. So if you say this is a miraculous piece of evidence, what stops someone else coming along and saying, well, actually, you're just reading into that a miracle? We could simply say something's happened, we don't understand. It doesn't necessarily mean that God's at work. Yeah. Mm. Now, all of those challenges, I think, are important for us to take seriously. We're part of that tradition of Western philosophy, which shapes us as much as the Judeo-Christian tradition has shaped us. And Christians, I think, need to hear those challenges and think them through.
I mean, do you have a sympathy with the, you know, we're going back a couple hundred years now, but the way that Hume posed the problem for miracles and for God's intervention in that sense?
Yes, there's a lot of debate about this, and I'm not sure I want to sort of pitch in with Hume on everything. But what I thought he said was brilliant was to say, what is the greater miracle?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. If I have a coffee mug on my coffee table and I leave the room and I come back and it's not there, what's the greater miracle? That it's suddenly disappeared, or that I actually forgot that I'd moved it before. So it's always, when you're assessing a miracle, what's the more implausible answer? So is it that the resurrection happened? Is that more implausible? Or is it more implausible that people had experiences that led them to believe
the phrase you used, something like the negation of the miracle would need to be more implausible than the miracle in order for it to be, you know, to be likely in that sense?
It's really important to, when you come to all of these different philosophers, to just remember where they're starting from. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting things about Hume was he was objecting against Christians who were at that time using miracles to prove the existence of God.
Okay.
So this was exactly what you're doing.
Well,
you said that all your struggles you can cope with because you know that through the life and resurrection of Jesus. Well, if Jesus didn't resurrect, then his life was vacuous. Well, not, he was just a wonderful person, but so you are, that's exactly what you are doing.
Now, I'm wanting to do something slightly different, although I accept that it could appear to be that. First thing is that I'm not trying to prove God through historical evidence. I don't think that you can prove God. I think evidence leads you to a certain point at which then trust and relationship take over. What Hume was objecting to was an intellectual proof going on.
Okay, but I don't see how you believe. I can't understand what your faith is based on.
Well, my faith is based, first of all, on the historical evidence. Yes, for the resurrection, but I don't think that can be proved.
Okay.
I mean, let me go back to proof, if I may, because people often ask me this as a scientist, you know, shouldn't you be into proof? As a cosmologist, we never use the word proof. proof is not something that we work with.
Okay, I'm happy not to use proof, but I just want to know why you believe.
It's the best interpretation of the evidence, number one. Secondly,
but you said
my
I don't know when you've had all your experiences with your wife's illness and all your friends.
Oh no,
all of that is saying I don't know. It's just confusing. It the experience is not backing up your faith.
The claim that God is love and God is at work in the world is the best explanation I have for the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. The historical evidence of Jesus of Nazareth.
Let David finish his point.
And then absolutely. We'll come back to you.
Secondly, I want to say that Christian experience is much more than experiences of answered prayer. So the whole realm of experience as a Christian, which is about the sense of being loved, the sense of forgiveness, the sense of hope, the sense of those moments of thankfulness, of gratitude, in which I find a subjective experience of God. Then there's a small part of that which is about answered or unanswered prayer.
Okay.
So my whole Christian experience isn't simply about answered or unanswered prayer.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's that which I want to say is different from Hume. Hume was reacting against the philosophers who were saying...
we'll come back to you.
Okay.
Who were saying, let me give you an intellectual proof of the existence of God, Ed. So here's a miracle. The only explanation, they would say, of that unusual thing that's happened is God. Therefore, believe. It's as simple as that. It's as obvious as that. And Hume rightly said, no, it's not as obvious as that. How you interpret the evidence, far more subtle, far more complex. And actually, for me, Christian faith isn't simple proof, therefore God exists. It's actually looking at the world in a number of different ways, looking at a whole number of raft of things, from historical evidence to present experience, to the way the cosmos is, to the way the world works, and saying, what is the best way that interprets all of this, which chimes with my experience?
We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back to it. I know you're keen to come back on this in a moment's time. So you're listening to a really interesting discussion today. Ed Atkinson, our atheist in the studio, David Wilkinson, our Christian. We're asking, does prayer make sense? We've got into the whole area of how we justify our faith as well in the latter part of today's programme. So come back in a moment's time. This is Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored. Welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Don't forget that Unbelievable is part of Faith Explored every Saturday afternoon, and you can hear the profile between 4 and 5 today. Rico Tice is one of the guests there. He's the evangelist at All Souls Langham Place, and he's going to be talking about a new book on honest evangelism to Sam Hales in the profile. You can also find today's show online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Perhaps you'd like to leave a comment underneath the show, and we'll be hearing some of your comments from the emails as well later on. Next week on the programme, a bit of a special edition as I play out the audio of a recent discussion I hosted between the Templeton Prize winner Jean Vanier and a group of students, both RE, undergraduate and sixth form level students. Jean Vanier, if you haven't heard of him, is the founder of the L'Arche movement. That's a network of communities around the world where people with learning disabilities live with people who are care for them and who are their peers in a way. It really is profound work. It's been going on for 50 years and Jean Vanier has been so influential in breaking down some of the barriers of stigma towards people with learning or intellectual disabilities. So he received the Templeton Prize last month, £1.1 million, which of course is going to be put back into the work of L'Arche. But I was able to interview him recently for Premier Christianity magazine. That's available on the website if you want to look at it there, premierchristianity.com. But next week you'll be hearing this discussion that I had with Jean and a number of students shortly after the Templeton Prize, in fact the day after it was recorded, and I hope you enjoy that. Something a little bit different on next week's show.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Yeah, so wrapping up this discussion on Does Prayer Make Sense with David Wilkinson and Ed Atkinson, I'm going to make sure to link to both my guests, the book that David's written on this subject, and where you can find out more about Ed and the meetings he hosts and that sort of thing between believers and non-believers with the today's programme. So go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable to find the show, to find the details, and indeed to leave your comments as well. It's always an active place of the website where people engage in what's happened on the show. Be interested to hear your thoughts on it. You can, of course, do that as well via our Facebook and Twitter account. You can equally send me an email directly, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and we'll hear some of your thoughts from recent shows a little later on in today's programme. We're having quite a feisty interaction just at the end of that last section, gentlemen, and Ed, keen to make sort of come back on some of the points David was making. So let's just make as much time as we can now in this final part for that conversation. Because, I mean, what I was hearing from you, Ed, was, hang on a minute, David, you say these people were mistaken for trying to prove God through a miraculous event, but you, that was part of your explanation for the justification of your faith is the miracle of the resurrection and so on. So do you want to just carry on in that thread, in that
vein?
Yes. What's
calm down a bit. You said in the book how where God doesn't answer prayer, and you link that to suffering, and you face that head on. And you also say that really there's no answer for that one either. Yeah. And then you come back and say, but I base everything on the resurrection, well, the life and death of Jesus and his resurrection. So it seems to me that a massive amount of weight is being held by the evidence of the resurrection.
Yes.
And it's just not capable of bearing it. They're so easy to, as Hume did, but also when we dig into the actual evidence, that the resurrection clearly is not well attested.
Well, I disagree. I think the evidence is very strong for the resurrection. The other thing that I'd want to say is that I don't want to put everything on the resurrection. I think the life and death of Jesus is just as important, and particularly when it comes to suffering the death of Jesus, which for Christians has been one of the ways which we've seen God suffering with the world. And that's very important. But I think it would be a longer conversation about the evidence for the resurrection. But nevertheless, it's not proof. You and I, at the end of the day, may come to different conclusions on it. And I'm very open to the fact that we couldn't sit in the studio and I would convince you, without doubt, that there's enough evidence for the resurrection. I think the evidence has to be interpreted.
And inevitably will be interpreted somewhat by the other factors that come into our experience. You might be prepared to give more weight to the same evidence if you've got other factors which kind of are, you know, cohere with that as well, like having an experience, maybe a very subjective experience, I suppose, of believing that God has in some way acted in your life.
Very much so. It depends on our worldview. It depends on our experience at different times of our lives. Tom Wright, who wrote this very large book on the historical resurrection of the Son of God, tells a story where he sent it to his former philosophy professor and wondered what the professor would say. And the professor wrote back and said, "Tom, thank you very much. Very impressive book, but I choose not to take that interpretation because I think at some point there will be another interpretation of it." Now, I think that there's an openness to that, which actually says that we can't convince in proof of the resurrection.
Yeah.
It's open to discussion.
Yeah, well, I read that book. It's a brilliant book.
You've read the whole thing?
Yeah, it's quite the volume,
isn't it?
Yeah.
But go ahead.
I mean, I don't know if it's appropriate, but the account in 1 Corinthians 15,
yes,
which is considered to be an early creed, so it's very close to the original events, that is the bedrock of the discussion.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mention an empty tomb. It just discusses things going on in people's heads.
Well, I disagree with that. I think the phrase "and was buried" is quite clear in Paul. And Tony Thistleton's commentary on 1 Corinthians 15, as well as Tom's work on this work, will argue this very strongly, that Paul didn't need to say that by the phrase "and was buried" in 1 Corinthians 15. There's a very clear reference there to the empty tomb. Now, what Paul doesn't do, absolutely right, is say, "Let me show you the evidence for the empty tomb." He does talk, however, about the people who have experienced the risen Jesus and says some of them are still alive. Go down the street and have a chat with them if you want to. And I think at that stage it was simply accepted that the empty tomb was there.
You look like you want to come up.
Yeah. You're assuming it's a tomb. You would expect, with no other information, that a crucified victim would be put in a, I think a sand grave is one of the documents has it, but basically a communal grave, or even left out to the, Paul says he was buried, so he was buried in a communal grave. That would be what you'd expect, which isn't visitable, is not evidence.
You think Paul would most likely have been referring to a kind of traditional, under the ground grave rather than a...
If the Gospels weren't available to us, that's what we'd assume.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but the Gospels are available to us, and the interesting part at the end of John's Gospel, where Joseph Arimathea and Nicodemus look after the body, I think for me is indicative that something was different about the burial of Jesus. I mean, whether it was the classic kind of Easter Sunday children's depiction of a round stone and all the rest of it, well, the Gospels have some uncertainty as they describe it. So I'm not wedded to a particular view of this, but I am sure that it was a tomb in terms of the witness of the Gospels.
Yeah, I mean, we're obviously going off in a very different tangent here.
I'd just love to carry on.
Wouldn't it be fun? We should do the resurrection argument at some point down the road, right? But we don't have time to do it justice, of course, today. I mean, all this, I suppose, brings us back, though. We've started to have a conversation about whether there's good evidence for the resurrection and so on, to the fact that, for you, if we're just looking at prayer, we don't have that kind of evidence. We can't even, I suppose, at some level... talk in these terms we've just been talking about, with historical evidence for the resurrection, about evidence for the results of prayer. Because in your view, Ed, correct me if I'm wrong, but you just think that we tend to interpret whatever we have depending on whether we are a Christian or not a Christian, in a sense. And if you're not a Christian, you'll just see sometimes things happen when we pray, sometimes they don't, and there's no sort of...
Yeah, that's right.
Correlation, really.
Yes. I felt the book, which I've read it through, David's book we're talking about, that it didn't really end on a particularly positive note. You spent a lot of time talking about Alice and your wife and people's misunderstanding of maybe why they should expect more from God than they're going to get. And the science stuff, which I thought was great. But it never ended with positive feeling. It's always like explaining why God doesn't do things rather than encouraging you to pray and seeing God do amazing things.
Hmm. I mean, do you believe God does
miraculously? Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And for a number of reasons that I think it's not ruled out by science, because I think there's good evidence in terms of the God that I see in Jesus. And I pray expectantly and I pray honestly. And I keep praying for my wife's healing. And I keep praying that God would heal the world. Mm. I do so expectantly, but with realism as well. And I think it's a fair point, Ed. I suppose what I want to argue is that Christians have a bit more realism when it comes to prayer. I think the setting of false expectations it can lead to this disillusionment with prayer. And the biblical witness itself is realistic. It talks about unanswered prayer. It talks about Paul having a thorn in the flesh and praying three times for it to be removed, and it wasn't. And there's no explanation given on why that is. My grace is sufficient for you, says the Lord. But why that's not answered, we don't know. And I think the Bible itself gives us a realism, a messiness to it.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to have to end there. Ed, thank you so much for coming in
and great,
posing
thanks.
The questions today. You want to come back and do the resurrection at some point, don't you?
We had a brilliant night on it in our discussion group.
Well, look, maybe at some point we could put a microphone in there and see what happens at this discussion group of yours. Because this is a really interesting little project you've developed since discovering Unbelievable about a year ago. You've developed this discussion group between believers and non-believers. And you meet about once a month, is it?
That's right.
Kind of just have an open discussion, maybe hear a talk and then discuss on the back.
Yeah, we try and keep the talk reasonably short so that the discussion could be all one big group, and then in the second half just around small tables, we carry on.
Yeah, it sounds a bit like an Alpha course, but for kind of run by an atheist instead.
Well, I've got my fellow Christian who runs it with me.
Well, that sounds great. And if you're interested in finding out more, go to the Unbelievable page. You may be able to go to the one that you currently run in Henley, but you're hoping to get one set up at some point down the line in London as well.
Yeah, I'd love that. So I'm sort of predicting the future here, but if you perhaps Google Meetup, one word, maybe Unbelievable, yeah, and London. Hopefully there'll be a link to something that
I will make
after
sure
recording
that,
this will be set up.
This show will contain whatever information I can include on the webpage about that. So look out for that at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Also the place to go for links to the new book by David Wilkinson, When I Pray, What Does God Do? Thank you very much for joining us as well, David. It's been great fun. And thank you for listening to the programme today. Not finished yet, though. We're going to hear some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme. Stay tuned here to Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you'd like to respond to anything you heard on today's show, the email address is unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Plenty of people Facebook and tweet me during the week, though, so if you want to do it that way, @unbelievablejb to follow me on Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb to follow the Facebook page. And we've got some of your comments coming in this week by Facebook. Skeptic Mom got in touch with me. She has been writing on a blog. It's called the Skeptic Mom blog, and one of her most recent posts was, "I have a new favourite podcast to add to my list of favourite podcasts. The podcast is called Unbelievable. The most surprising thing about this podcast, it is a Christian podcast. I never expected a Christian podcast to make my list of favourite podcasts, but this one does. The aim of the show is to get Christians and non-Christians talking about a variety of interesting topics. The show often has a Christian and an atheist discussing a particular topic. The host, Justin Brierley, does a great job of letting the guests have an honest discussion. Each side has an opportunity to make his or her points, and Mr. Brierley does an excellent job summing up the points a guest is making, even when he disagrees with them. Another aspect of the show I really like is it doesn't contain any explicit language. This makes it something I can listen to in front of the kids without having to worry that they'll be introducing a new word they learned on it during school. Of course, there may be some topics that are inappropriate for some age groups. My 9-year-old daughter enjoys the show as well. I think she likes to think about the big issues. She actually requests to listen to it when we're taking trips in the car. As I spend a lot of time listening to podcasts, I'm thrilled to have one more to add to my rotation. And I'm even more thrilled to have finally found a family-friendly one that I enjoy. I'm so pleased to hear from you, Skeptic Mom, and for getting in touch to point me towards your blog as well. And I'm very glad that the fact that you don't hear explicit language on this show, it means you're able to share it with your 9-year-old daughter. I don't know, perhaps the youngest Unbelievable listener. I don't know if you have a son or daughter or know someone young who listens, younger than 9 years old, be interested to hear as well. But great to hear from you, and thanks for getting in touch. So we've got some of your thoughts on the recent shows we had on science and religion last week. That was Eugenie Scott of the National Center for Science Education out in the US, an atheist, biologist by background, and Ruth Bansovitz of the Faraday Institute, an author of the new book God in the Lab, discussing science and religion, faith in God. Tim Tiley says that he really enjoyed that show. Very stimulating. He said two very good speakers. Also enjoyed the talk on suffering from Spring Harvest that preceded it on Premier Radio. Glad you enjoyed that, Tim. Again, if you want to listen back to those, we'll try and make some of those available in the future online as well, but those were just aired on the radio in the last few weeks. Here's Ken Miller in Benfleet talking about that show with Eugenie and Ruth. It says, once Ruth informed us that she was a theistic evolutionist, I knew she would come off badly. Richard Dawkins loves discussions with theistic evolutionists because he gets them to rubbish things in the first book of the Bible. From then on, they've lost the moral high ground. I think I'm right when I say Dawkins won't take on a well-known creationist scientist. The question to ask atheist evolutionists is, as a supporter of Darwin's theory of evolution, can you explain why after all this time and the discovery of millions of fossils, we have yet to find any evidence of change from one kind of creature to another kind of creature? Unfortunately, too many Christians have bought into the lie of evolution and have abandoned the truth of Scripture. Eugenie also claimed the Christian faith keeps changing. I was unaware the New Testament had gone through any changes since its compilation around the 3rd century AD, unlike the world of evolution, where things are constantly being overwritten. So Ken wasn't the only person who wanted to see more of a young earth creationist approach. Next time we do these kinds of topics, Daniel says Bob Enyart debated Eugenie Scott about her number one reason scientifically why she's an atheist humanist, and it was the concept of junk DNA. She claimed in 2005 that we knew all the basic components of DNA and there was nothing more to learn. She said this before the epigenetic and sugar code frontier that we're in today. I respectfully request that you provide young earth creationism the opportunity to be defended or debated without the use of scripture and only through the use of the most recent scientific findings. I think that young earth creationism deserves its place to not be mocked and scorned to the point of making people think that young earth creation is a non-scientific ideology. Science can show that the earth is young and can be firmly established with only scientific evidence. There's a rash of non-young earth creation scientists that are providing the evidence. And you'd like to see that if we do this again on the show. In the meantime, Nate says, long-time listener, very much a fan of the show. I've been thinking about formulating an argument for the truth of theism from the lack of atheist moderators who are fair-minded and friendly like Justin. Only joking. Anyway, I largely enjoyed this exchange, but found myself wishing I could ask Eugenie Scott questions when she said, we make our own meaning. I wanted to ask her how this is any different from merely pretending to have meaning. Additionally, when speaking of the arrow, which may point from religion to science and vice versa, I see no reason why the arrow couldn't point in either direction, depending on the circumstances. For example, homosexual behaviour is clearly forbidden by the Bible, and so we should expect that those who engage in it will experience, on average, poorer life outcomes, which is indeed the case when it comes to longevity, drug use, probability of depression, etc. On the other hand, the only information the Bible gives us on the mechanics of human genesis is that we are made from the dust of the earth, if one takes that literally, which I and most others do. There are many possible ways in which we could have been made from the dust of the earth. Let's list some. A dust devil swirls around, arranging the dust in a just-so fashion. God individually moves particles of dust to construct a human. Warring velociraptors serendipitously arrange dust. Biological evolution. I really can't think of a more plausible way in which God could have made us from the dust than evolution. Anyway, thanks again, Justin. Thank you, Nate. Here's Clay Hardwick, who got in touch via Facebook and says, I wasn't sure which direction the show would take. From listening to the show, I did gather that Ruth Bancevich desires to open the door for scientists to gain a better understanding of how exactly theists and more specifically Christians interact with the many varieties of science. Eugenie Scott represented a sceptical viewpoint which gave high ranking to a scientific humanistic framework in all scientific vocations. The discussion between the two scientists was interesting, but no big surprise at the end of the conversation. Ruth continues her journey in the confidence of her Christian faith, while Eugenie continues her journey in the confidence of a humanistic view and a high dose of scepticism. Eugenie, towards the end of the show, explained that she's not a person with a bleak outlook. Well, I have to insert some of my thoughts here. Even though Eugenie can explain to the audience that she holds a view that to her personally is not bleak, I've got to chip in and say to Eugenie, no, it is bleak. I have no hesitation on that. Maybe Eugenie and her close friends at the local humanist chapter can make some persuasive testimony about how they don't see their life being meaningless or bleak. But I say that it is, at the core, bleak. And why do I say it? Because I see that no matter the circumstances or background around the world, humans seek to transcend their material physical existence, with or without Jesus Christ as part of that picture. I think you can see this occurring all the way down through human history. I don't perceive it as some psychological aberration that humans want to transcend. It's perfectly normal to have this thirst or desire because God put it there. It distinguishes humans from the rest of the creatures, which is why we study science. Anyway, thank you very much. Couldn't read all of your email, but thank you. You sign yourself off as an unbelievable podcast addict. Perry says, latest show, excellent. I'd seen Eugenie's name all over the place for years, but had never actually heard her. What an utterly refreshing alternative voice for the secular side compared to the Four Horsemen. Very likable. I hope to meet her someday. Near the end, Eugenie said the universe is purposeless, and the only purpose is what we bring to it. I wish Ruth Bancevich had been able to respond. This is precisely where the theistic view provides a better scientific vision for the future. Purposelessness is
an impossible proposition to prove. Thus, it's not even a scientific hypothesis. However, we can hypothesize that a system or process is purposeful. In principle, any such hypothesis is verifiable. We can prove that when a bacterium is under stress, mutation rates immediately spike by a factor of 100,000. We observe that it is trying to re-engineer its DNA to survive. That's why antibiotics are in an arms race against superbugs. Eugenie said that the more we learn about the universe, the more purposeless it appears to be. I disagree. The more we learn about the universe, the more fine-tuned it is, so much so that people hypothesize other universes to escape the impression that ours is special. We're not in any position to declare the universe is purposeless, any more than scientists in the 1970s were in a position to declare that 97% of our DNA was junk. Today, we know the junk DNA hypothesis was wrong. The NCSE promotes purposelessness, which is anti-science. If you expect no purpose, you tend not to see it. But if you expect even more layers of order in the universe, that hypothesis tends to be rewarded, thus giving teachers more to teach and scientists more to discover. And finally, Ray Chung says, congratulations on another top-notch show. I found both positions somewhat lacking, but I won't go into that here. I hope to join in the discussion, that's the comment section underneath the show, when time allows. I just wanted to say, I loved Ruth's voice. Maybe you could get her back to present something. But jovialness aside, great moderation once again. You also wanted to say that you appreciated the previous show, Ray, Are Muslims Turning to Christ Around the World? You say, very impressed with David Garrison, the graciousness and the expertise with which he answered his discussion partners was hugely impressive. Thanks again for such a great show. You're doing us one heck of a service, if I may use that phrase. In fact, I moderated your phrase for the sake of our family-friendly listener that I mentioned at the beginning. But anyway, thank you very much for getting in touch, Ray. And yeah, that's about all we've time for. Maybe we can squeeze in one from Richard Watson, who says, again, of that Wind in the House of Islam episode of 2 weeks ago, a fascinating discussion, which is usually the case that the Muslim apologists modified everything they could in Islam to fit the argument. We heard that those said to convert were largely not true Muslims, even though they could recite the Quran and in some cases were imams. That's a classic argument that everyone who does what they don't like never was part of their group by their own definition. But it's an argument that holds not a drop of water. And you go on to give some of your other feelings on that show. But yes, I had a number of other people get in touch to say they appreciated that show too. We'll maybe bring some more feedback to shows next week. For the moment, thank you for joining me on today's program. And if you can come back at the same time next week, well, let me tell you what you'll be hearing then.
You're unbelievable.
Going to be joined by Jean Vanier, the winner of the recent Templeton Prize. He has spent a lifetime changing attitudes as a Christian theologian and as the founder of L'Arche towards people with disabilities. Well, I recently moderated a discussion between him and a group of young students, and you'll be hearing some of their conversation at the same time next week. So do look forward to you being with me then. For the moment, have a great week. The Profile is here next.
Faith-filled finance. All major UK bank accounts. One app. Provision helps you see where your money's going and steward it in line with your values. Download now at provision.money and use code PREMIER to get your first month free. That's provision.money.